Anna.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, November 15th, 2009. Probably for about two decades now, the Christian right, if not longer than two decades, the Christian right has been a dominant theme in American politics, its role, both of praise and criticism. Yet we don't know a great deal about this phenomenon. Today we're going to have an author, an expert on the subject, who has spent years studying the Christian right among their ranks and will report back to us on what he had found. Our guest today will be Max Blumenthal, author of Republican Gomorrah. But before we go to our guest, let's get ready with Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
One of the beautiful things about the Internet is that everyone using it gets treated the same. Whether you're uploading or downloading, streaming video or calling a friend, emailing your resume, or researching used cars. This principle of no discrimination, known as net neutrality, is the main reason why the Internet has become as vast and as useful as it is today. But it should not be taken for granted. Internet service providers like Comcast and AT&T want to get rid of net neutrality. They claim it hampers their ability to manage traffic when the web gets congested. Some of the ISP's preferred tactics for Internet management, like blocking certain websites or speeding up their own services while slowing down their competition, have nothing to do with congestion and everything to do with making more money. But there are other tactics that aren't as clearly defined as a breach of the net neutrality principle, like prioritizing web traffic. ISPs want to speed up video and voice applications while downgrading others. Chris Riley, Policy Counsel of Free Press, has written a paper with Rob Topolsky of the New America Foundation that explains why so-called application bias ultimately works against Internet users and undermines the overall health of the Internet.
What they're trying to do is use this concept of making video and voice work faster as a way to get the same kinds of control over the Internet that we've been fighting against all along. Anytime an ISP is picking some applications to be sped up and others to be slowed down, they're at the same time picking others that get penalized. So what the ISP is doing here is really taking the choice out of the user's hands.
Riley says there haven't been any conclusive studies saying that prioritization will make any difference in easing traffic congestion. Well-designed applications don't need prioritization to work well, he says. But if ISPs are allowed to prioritize, the incentive for making better products disappears.
What you're going to do is you give a handout to some company that doesn't have as good of a product. And so you're again allowing the network operator to sort of skew competition and skew user choice.
The FCC is currently making net neutrality rules that will officially define non-discrimination. Riley says non-discrimination should mean that ISPs cannot do anything that prioritizes traffic in a way that trumps what the users want and need. He says it's important for the FCC to keep its eye on the real goal, a world-class high-speed internet that helps drive the U.S. economy and brings U.S. citizens the communications infrastructure they need to lead productive lives.
The more ISPs are allowed to prioritize and discriminate among traffic, the less incentive they have to build a bigger pipe. And basically what we want to do is create every incentive we can for the ISP to build a really big, fast internet connection. And prioritization is a disincentive towards doing that.
To read The Hidden Harms of Application Bias by Chris Riley and Rob Topolsky, go to savetheinternet.com.
On Wednesday night, Lou Dobbs announced he was leaving his nightly newscast on CNN. The cable channel's 7 p.m. anchor has drawn extensive criticism for his anti-immigrant views and for giving a platform to conspiracy theory claims that President Obama is not a U.S. citizen. Dobbs' departure comes nearly two full years before his contract was set to expire. Earlier this fall, Presente.org and an alliance of local allies across the country founded Basta Dobbs, a campaign devoted to educating the Latino community about the threat posed by CNN's Lou Dobbs. Another coalition, DropDobbs.com, which included large civil rights organizations and the watchdog group Media Matters, targeted Dobbs advertisers. Basta Dobbs released a statement saying they were thrilled that Dobbs no longer has this legitimate platform from which to incite fear and hate. In a move to expedite the federal government's efforts to expand high-speed internet access across America, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration and the Rural Utility Service announced they would be combining the two remaining application windows for the $7.2 billion set aside in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for broadband projects. This will leave applicants only one more chance to apply for funding. The move comes in response to criticisms that the funds are not being dispensed quickly enough. The first application window, which received 2,200 applications, closed in August. Those grants will be awarded in mid-December. The agencies have requested public comment on what changes should be made to the grant requirements. The comment period will last 2 weeks and will help establish the funding rules for the second window in early 2010. For more information, visit ntia.doc.gov.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, Max Blumenthal, is an award-winning journalist and blogger whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in the New York Times, The Daily Beast, The Nation, The Huffington Post, Salon.com, Al Jazeera English, and many other publications. We're here to talk about his new book, just released by Nation Books, a bestseller, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Max Blumenthal, welcome to Media Matters.
Great to be with you.
Max, how long has the book been out now?
It came out in early September.
And the book, just we'll start for listeners unfamiliar with it. Why the title for the book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party?
Well, the title Republican Gomorrah was inspired by the Gomorrah-like sea of scandals that flooded the party, from Ted Haggard, the anti-gay pastor's homosexual affair with a male escort, to Mark Foley's bizarre scandal that was covered up by the Republican leadership, to Tom DeLay's alleged criminality as he led the Republican Congress to the mountaintop and then led it into the valley that it's currently in. It's about the sea of it's a reference to the sea of scandals that flooded the party and that it basically drowned in, leading to its massive defeats in 2006 and staining the Republican brand by 2008. And of course, the image of the Republican Party that it's projected is the pro-family party, the party of, mom and apple pie, that's defined itself by God, gays, and guns, but in fact, the real picture of the party is something quite different, and I try to analyze why the party became that way and how it attracted people who were running away from themselves into the party, and those people who themselves were very conflicted, how they threw the party into conflict by projecting their personal crises onto one of the two major parties, and bringing out Sarah Palin as the major figure of the party and shattering it on a national level, preventing it from being able to hold appeal among moderates and independents.
Max Blumenthal, how did you do the research for this book, which, as you've already given an outline of, is a fairly extensive look at a number of main players in the Christian right movement over the last three or four decades?
For the past 6 years, I've covered this movement, along with other factions of the right, primarily the Christian right, because I was interested in the movement that I thought substantially controlled the Republican grassroots and had enormous influence in the Bush White House. That's when I got into journalism. sort of what inspired me to get in was the fact that the mainstream media was derelict on this movement and would try to be fair and balanced and give equal hearing to people like Tony Perkins and James Dobson, who are extremists. And, you know, I saw Tony Perkins on Hardball with Chris Matthews, and Chris Matthews is calling this guy a great American who was, crusading to institutionalize religious discrimination, and as I had revealed at The Nation, had palled around with white supremacist groups when he was a politician in Louisiana. And so I wanted to, reveal what this movement's real intentions were through reporting, just by picking up the phone and calling its leaders, going to its conferences and meeting with its followers and recording and documenting this history of the movement through extensive research. And what wound up happening was I came across a component of the movement that I think hadn't been revealed, which is the political psychology, just in talking to the followers of the movement and its leaders, especially the ones who are successful. I discovered that behind the, and we can get into this more in the show, that behind
yeah,
the,
definitely we will.
Behind the politics of resentment was a peculiar culture of personal crisis, confession, and transcendence that really defined and animated the politics that I think no one in the secular media had tried to understand. And so that's part of what inspired me to write my book.
The book has many conversations with you or your participation in events that are hosted by the Christian right. And as you said, you've been writing about them for many years now and in a critical vein. And there's one instance where you're actually sort of tossed out of a Sarah Palin event towards the end of the book. But otherwise, in the book, it seems like you had surprising access to people involved with the Christian right.
Well, I often carry a camera. And as Susan Sontag said, in America, you're not on TV, you're nobody. People within the Christian right believe that as well. They want to go on camera and express their views, and they don't realize, they have no capacity for self-reflection, most of them, so they don't realize that mainstream America thinks that these views are extreme. So what they say is very sincere and earnest, even though it might seem extreme and even unintentionally hilarious to many people. And without a camera, I think I can be even more disarming, because I simply just will go to their conferences or to their rallies and ask them basic questions. I'm not there to argue with them or to humiliate anybody. And I wish that, more of the progressive media would do the same. I think the blogging phenomenon can be sort of counterproductive when bloggers rely so often on the mainstream media and just frame what the mainstream media does instead of going and reporting themselves.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Max Blumenthal, author of the new book, just published by Nation Books, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. It's a national bestseller. It is a deep and thick description, explanation, portrayal of the key figures of the Christian right politically in the United States going back decades, but also with a strong emphasis on the prominent recent events. You've already mentioned Mark Foley and Sarah Palin, and we could go on and on. Everyone's in the book. And it will be a presentation of this material, unlike anything I've seen before that I think is available presently. I want to talk about some of the social psychology that you go into, which I find so interesting. But before we do, I think to give our listeners a real sense of some of the meat in the book, take some time, if you would, Max Blumenthal, and talk about James Dobson, a name that I think most Americans are familiar with. You hear about him occasionally as sort of a Christian right leader. But I think, like myself, it sort of floats in the background. It doesn't really register. He just sort of is another one of these names like Falwell and Swaggart and Robertson that sort of drifts by. In your book, Dobson, if I may say so, assumes really, I would say, almost a starring role.
Yeah. And the reason that he assumes a starring role is because I think he's played a greater role than Falwell or Robertson in cultivating the sensibility of the movement, in defining what the movement is culturally. While Robertson and Falwell have been really successful politically, I think Dobson would become more powerful And it was because he wasn't a religious figure, even though he led a religious movement. He was not a theological expert. In fact, he has no theological credentials. But he is, in fact, a child psychologist who understands the culture of personal crisis that animates the movement. Dobson's fame and fortune came from a little book called Dare to Discipline that he wrote in 1970. And this book, he wrote it because he was appalled and disgusted by the counterculture. And he blamed Dr. Benjamin Spock, who much of the baby boom generation had been raised on, you know, on his child-rearing tactics. He blamed Spock for the counterculture. He called Spock the godfather of permissiveness. And Spock was also attacked by Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president. So Dobson wrote Dare to Discipline, another child-rearing manual, to raise up a new generation of Republican radicals who would demonstrate respect for authority and God and would take the country back from the hippies. And what his book really was a manual for child abuse. Dobson said that children should have their neck muscles pinched until they submitted to parents, that they should be hit with a neutral object, like a switch, because hands are for loving, that pain is a marvelous purifier, and that the child should be spanked with sufficient magnitude as to make him cry. When the child is done crying, he will want to crumple to your breast. And the child should be welcomed with warm and loving arms. So essentially Dobson is recommending hitting and loving at the same time, which is actually sadomasochism. Not sexual sadomasochism, but a different kind of sadomasochism that Eric Fromm, the psychologist, discusses in his book, Escape from Freedom, which really forms a lot of the central ideas behind my book. And what Fromm said is that sadomasochism is the essential characteristic of the authoritarian personality. They're sadistic in that they have a tendency or desire to harm and punish those who they perceive as weaker than them or as social deviants, homosexuals, the poor, foreigners, minorities, Jews. And at the same time, they're masochistic, in that they yearn to bow down and prostrate themselves before those who they perceive as stronger than them, a strong leader like Dobson, or even Sarah Palin, or the macho Jesus from Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. And Dobson has cultivated that sadomasochistic tendency in the movement through his child-rearing techniques. His book has been reprinted over a dozen times. It's sold millions of copies, and his radio show is one of the top five radio shows in the country, but he rarely, although he just quit his radio show for the past 30 years, he's rarely talked about politics. What he talks about is the child-rearing techniques in his book, how to, you know, fix your marriage, how to solve your child's bedwetting problem. And he brings people in to his empire, Focus on the Family, with, through this help, and they can write to his correspondence department. And they're entered into a database after they receive Dobson-approved advice, and then they're bombarded with political mailings, and then he slowly transforms them into Republican shock troops and wields them against the Republican Party like a magic wand every election year, forcing the party to put up these radical candidates, including Sarah Palin, who John McCain selected in part to appease James Dobson, who had attacked McCain publicly as a liberal and said he refused to vote for him. So this is so from the culture of personal crisis, we get the, in my opinion, this culture has shaped the radical character of the Republican Party and taken it to where it is today, where all the moderates are fleeing, and people who have actually been raised, and I think this is empirically provable, and I demonstrate it through my book, people who have been raised on Dobson's techniques are taking over the party.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is Max Blumenthal, the journalist and the author of the new book by Nation Books, the national bestseller, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. We're talking about the political right right now. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Max Blumenthal, the number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And just to be a little more concrete about Max, about James Dobson's political influence, I mean, virtually every major Republican figure in Congress or national politics in the last 10 or 15 years, as I read your book, has basically had to have a road that went right through James Dobson to sort of guarantee their power.
Absolutely. And every Republican primary candidate has to show their wares before Dobson and his flock at the Value Voters Summit, which is a new convention Dobson and Tony Perkins have been hosting. You have to go on Dobson's radio show if you're a Republican leader in the Senate or the House. And many of the people who led the Republican Congress when it was in power were actually converted by Dobson personally, like Tom DeLay, who was once known as Hot Tub Tommy when he was an alcoholic, philandering, no-name legislator in Texas. But he was transformed through the techniques of Dobson, through the teachings of Dobson, when he came into Congress in Washington, into the Hammer, this dictatorial, sadistic leader who hung two bullwhips behind his desk and advocated a strict dominionist interpretation of Christianity that should be installed in place of the Constitution. So Dobson has had a personal effect on a lot of the leaders of Congress, in addition to holding meetings in the Capitol basement where he threatened pull support for the party and form a third party in 1996 if the party didn't implement his vision for society, which included abolishing the National Endowment for the Arts, defunding Planned Parenthood, and a whole host of radical policies. And at this meeting, Dobson reduced one congressman's wife to tears. And this is part of what gave rise to the C Street House and so many of the evangelical right-wing institutions on Capitol Hill was the influence of figures like Dobson in, first of all, bringing these candidates into Washington who subscribed to his teachings and to this strict dominionist doctrine and bonding them together and using them as sort of cell groups against Republican moderates and against the Democrats.
You know, Max Blumenthal, as I was listening to you now and as I read the book, what was astonishing to me, and I shouldn't have been naive about this, and I probably knew this, but it didn't really become as clear as it did until I read your book, that although these are people who were self-professed Christians and self-professed extremely pious people, what was astonishing was what you just said about Tom DeLay, which was the notion that the ends justify the means and that it was entirely appropriate to have a hypocritical, entire double standard in which insiders who were part of the team got treated differently than those outside.
Right. Right. I mean, and we saw that recently with what happened in the C Street House, where all of these legislators who are close to Dobson, who are from the movement, from Mark Sanford, who lived there when he was a representative, who's an ordained Baptist minister and a right-wing evangelical, to Chip Pickering, another right-wing evangelical who's the son of a notorious white supremacist from Mississippi, or alleged white supremacist, who himself spoke to a white supremacist group in 2002, to John Ensign, the only Pentecostal in the Senate, extremely right-wing senator from Nevada. These guys all had extramarital affairs, either in this house, this Christian fellowship, the C Street House, or they conducted cover-ups, conspiring with other members of the C Street House to cover up their actions inside the C Street House. And the whole point of it is that these guys believe they were elected by Christ to serve in government, and therefore, they were not accountable to their constituents. They weren't accountable to secular society. They were only accountable to each other and to God. And when Mark Sanford confessed his affair with his Latina lover, which he carried out largely through state taxpayer money when he was governor of South Carolina, in this press conference, and the mainstream press completely missed this part, he said, the reason why we follow God's law is because when we follow God's law in order to restrain the self from the self. In other words, we have to do what God wants us to do. Because if we do what we want to do, we will tend to do some really freaky stuff. And that's what they believe. That's part of the psychology that Dobson has cultivated. It's the idea that the self is inherently sinful. I mean, it comes from Calvinism. John Calvin said once that he was looking at a baby in its crib and he saw the baby seething with sin. But the self is inherently sinful, it's bad, and the self has to be dissolved and eradicated through authoritarian child-rearing techniques and authoritarian politics. And that's what Eric Fromm warned about in 1941 when he wrote this book, Escape from Freedom, that those who fear personal freedom, those who can't handle the pressures of open society and a democratic culture, will inevitably form authoritarian structures and follow authoritarian leaders. And so that's who the followers and many of the leaders of the Christian right are, people who are afraid of themselves and who need to do what God wants them to do. And it's of course, this macho Jesus who appears in Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. It's not the Prince of Peace or the loving God who appears in the Bible. It's very dangerous.
Our guest today, Max Blumenthal, you've been listening to the author of the new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. The number here at Media Matters on WILL AM 580 is 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Our phone lines are filling up quickly, so let's get right to the phones now. Let's start with line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Max Blumenthal.
Hello, am I on?
You are indeed.
Okay, thanks for having me on, and I haven't read the book yet. I'm highly interested. My question is regarding the theology of the folks that we're discussing. This heavy emphasis on spiritual warfare, that there's the forces of dark, there's forces with Satan, the forces with God, and there's no in-between. And it's us against them, you know, you're either with us or you're with Satan. And it leads to what I've seen in small group discussions among Christians, themes like, you know, Sarah Palin is anointed by God. Why? Because she struggled through all her personal crises and God touched her and she went from being to being a superstar. And I go, well, Obama did the same thing. They go, oh no, he's with Satan. Could you comment on that worldview of warfare, of the warrior? They talk about warrior anointing, and they got to be warriors in the army of the Lord. And how that ties into their apocalyptic view of they're besieged by the forces of evil. And I'll listen now.
Thank you very much, caller. Max Blumenthal?
Yeah, the concept of spiritual warfare is really important. I mean, it's central to this movement. Spiritual warfare is the idea that behind what we see in reality, there's a hidden battle between God and Satan, and that God and Satan essentially are controlling everything secretly, and we have to look for signs of this battle, which gives rise to this Manichaean worldview of the movement that the caller referred to, that it's completely black and white and there's no in-between. When I interviewed Tom DeLay in 2006 at a conference of Pastor John Hagee, this end-times theology proponent, who's become really influential through the Christian Zionist movement. Tom DeLay told me, in addition to the fact that he was waiting for the end times, that the criminal charges that had been brought against him for his illegal redistricting program in Texas were being brought against him by Satan. So in other words, everything bad that had befallen him was controlled by Satan, and everything good that he'd done because he was doing simply what God wanted him to do. So Tom DeLay could take no personal responsibility for his actions. It's no surprise if you externalize everything and see the world through this binary construct of good versus evil, that you're going to be a pretty corrupt person who can't take any responsibility for your actions. Sarah Palin believes the same thing. And when I went to Alaska, I spoke to some of her staunchest supporters, first at her church, her church of 20 years, the Wasilla Assembly of God, which openly discusses spiritual warfare. It's essential to their theology. Her church believes in the third wave, which is a Pentecostal theology that insists that there are demons that that possess secular society, that can possess people, that can possess places, that can possess entire cities. Therefore, to purge these demons out of society, prayer cells have to be formed that conduct constant prayer 24 hours a day. And this is a really good means of political organizing and spreading the faith. So Ted Haggard, who believed in the third wave, was seen when he first planted his church in Colorado Springs, anointing intersections with a garden sprayer and a bottle of Crisco oil. These are the kind of activities that they engage in. But I also spoke to some people at a anti-abortion rally in Anchorage, Alaska, about Sarah Palin, believers in spiritual warfare, and they told me that she was actually Queen Esther from the Bible, that she had the anointing. And Sarah Palin had, in fact, chosen Queen Esther as her biblical role model. Queen Esther was, like Sarah Palin, a beauty pageant contestant. She was a beauty queen who used her wiles to convince the king to not destroy her people. She basically used her beauty and intelligence to save the Jewish people. And these followers of spiritual warfare, these extreme evangelicals, saw themselves as a new kind of chosen people who lived in Alaska, which they told me was shaped like a crown, therefore was called to lead the nation. And Sarah Palin had been chosen by McCain, a king-like figure who is not necessarily sympathetic to these people. And Palin would essentially convince McCain to save them and ultimately bring them into the kingdom. This was the way that they saw things, and it's a narrative that continues. With Palin's book tour and her continued presence, magnified presence on the national scene.
Max Blumenthal, before we go back to the full bank of phone callers, and I asked for their patience, and I will get them soon, I do want to do a quick point that I don't want to get lost today, which is what was striking is that the Republican Party is traditionally regarded pre-Christian as the party of business, especially of big business. And in the book, business, for the most part, doesn't really appear. There are occasional sort of millionaire eccentrics who bankroll the group, but certainly not in the main line of Wall Street or the Fortune 500. The one exception seems to be the family that started the Blackwater Group, the Princes, which play a large role. And then there's also Steve Largent, the NFL football player who became a right-wing Christian member of Congress for many terms and is now making millions of dollars a year representing wireless telephone companies, running their lobby in Washington. What is
right.
the relationship between the corporate community, the traditional bastion of power within the Republican Party, and this sort of Christian right?
It's a tense relationship because the Christian right is naturally, I think, opposed to many of the goals of corporations, which is to reach as many consumers as possible, because the Christian right is such a divisive force. But there are people within the corporate world who have been converted to born-again Christianity who are sympathetic to and are members of the movement and believe that they were elected by God to these high positions in industry. And one of them was Edgar Prince, who was a car parts baron from Michigan, who made parts for GM and suffered a heart attack, became afraid of death. And I also I talk in my book about the role of the fear of death in producing the kind of anxiety that leads to these instant conversions. He was converted by Dobson, became one of Dobson's closest friends and financiers, financing the construction of the massive visitors center at Focus on the Family in Colorado Springs, and Focus on the Family is the number two most visited tourist site in Colorado. So this is hugely important. Edgar Prince's son, Eric Prince, went on to found Blackwater, the private mercenary corporation that's accused of committing crimes against humanity in Iraq.
Let's
and,
go to the
my friend. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was just going to let us get back to the phone lines at this moment because we have so many callers who have been waiting patiently to speak with Max Blumenthal, our guest today and the author of Republican Gomorrah. Let's go right now to line two, Urbana. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Yes. First, I just want to say I do look forward to reading this book. I haven't read it yet. But I guess the comment that I have is that from what you're saying, I mean, the things that you're talking about, sounds really extreme and right-wing. However, what they're doing seems to be working. I mean, they have the Democrats and the media are so afraid of being called liberal or being called socialist or anything that it's like whatever they've done is working, even though it's coming from such an extreme point of view. And I feel like if this is such an extremist viewpoint, they've somehow been able to get their point across to make it become more mainstream. And I think the media obviously has some culpability in that. And I just wanted to bring that point out and get your comments on that. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And yeah, that does get to the point you raised at the beginning of the show, which is how this movement has been covered by the media, which led you to figure you need to do a better job at it.
Right. The caller's right that the Christian right has exerted a disproportionate influence on the culture and politics. I mean, it's a movement that only represents about 12 to 15% of the population, but they have exerted control over one of the two major political parties, and they've gotten equal time in the media, and now they are the base of Fox News' viewership. And Fox News is the most popular network, which blends, I think, the cultural resentment that the movement likes with titillating cheap sexuality, which is really odd and goes to the hypocrisy at the heart of the movement on sexual politics. At the same time, what the movement has done with the Republican Party has been nothing short of disastrous. And that's why I say this is a movement that shattered the party. Just look at what happened in New York's 23rd district in the special election that happened a week and a half ago, where Sarah Palin and a bunch of far-right activists moved in endorsing a third-party unknown candidate against a really popular Republican candidate who was guaranteed victory because that Republican woman, one of the most accomplished women in New York Republican Party history, Dee Dee Scozzafava, was pro-choice and pro-gay. So the Republican had to step out of the race because she ran out of money, and the Democrat wound up winning against this extreme unknown third-party candidate who knew nothing about the district. And the Democrat won for the first time in that district in 100 years. This is the scenario that will be repeated over and over again if Sarah Palin and the Christian right continue to hold sway over the Republican Party. So I don't think that that they are a positive force in the party, or that they should be feared as much as I think so many progressives seem to fear them. I think what needs to happen is the energy that they've been able to produce on the right needs to be replicated on the left and used to pressure the White House and the Democratic Congress to actually do something. Because if it has nothing to talk about in 2010, there's no health care reform that's produced meaningful change in anybody's life, the Republicans will come back to power.
Our guest, Max Blumenthal, you've just been listening to the author of the new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Let's go back to the phone lines now to another caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Morris, you're on the air with Max Blumenthal.
Yeah, I was just calling in regards to a question I had about something that was commented on the show. What does Dr. Dobson being a Republican have anything to do with the correlation between the section of his book when he talks about spanking your kids and being authoritative towards them? And what would you suggest that you do? I mean, put them in their room with their iPod and TV and tell them to sit in the corner? I mean, what else is there to do? And back in, the older days, which was a different time, it wasn't frowned upon as much to spank your children. It wasn't that big of a deal. And then I'm sure he's not condoning to beat your children, just to punish them, for something kind of a wrongdoing they've done. And then I believe it was more effective, and people were more children than that were more apt to pay attention to authority and not to rebel as often, and you didn't see things like what you see today and with the acting out and things like that are happening. And I was just wondering, what would be your solution to that? What would be your better answer to that? I mean, because apparently what America's done in society is not working now, as you can see. But
can I ask the caller, where do you line up politically?
I think we lost our callers generally to clear the lines for other callers. They don't stay on. So I think you're going to have to answer that not knowing the caller's political preferences.
Well, I think the caller answered his own question when he asked what the connection is between spanking and right-wing politics by suddenly putting spanking into a political context and saying this is one of the ways to instill respect for authority, which is sort of a loaded phrase, among children, and to restore our society, because he said what's happening now isn't working. We're seeing rebellion in society. I think spanking, in fact, can produce, I mean, obviously, spanking isn't really the source of all these problems. It's the way that children are treated, and children shouldn't be put in their rooms with video games or neglected. That can produce more damage. I think the, you know, latchkey kids are you know, treated just as badly as children who are spanked by parents who are actually attentive to their needs, if not worse. And that there's no that the liberal style of parenting doesn't even exist. But back to the connection between spanking and politics. I mean, first of all, there's a new study out of the University of New Hampshire. It was reported in the L.A. Times in late September. It was a small sample group, so I think the study needs to be conducted again. It showed that children who are spanked consistently between the ages of 1 and 7 have a lower IQ than children who are not spanked, up to 5 to 10 points lower, which is really significant. That I mean, 5 to 10 points might not sound a lot, like a lot, but it's very significant. Beyond that, I just demonstrated in my book through journalism and historical research that many of the people who found their way into Dobson's empire after having massive personal crises were themselves abused as children. Newt Gingrich was mercilessly abused by his father. Tom DeLay was abused by his father, an alcoholic, and Ted Bundy, the worst serial killer in history, like most serial killers, was beaten mercilessly as a child, was converted by Dobson on death row, and became Dobson's anti-pornography poster child. So there is a clear connection through Dobson's child-rearing tactics and extreme conservatism. Otherwise, Dobson wouldn't have advocated those tactics.
You know, Max Blumenthal, there's not much time left in the program. We're down to the last 15 minutes or so, and we could do an entire program on something we haven't even discussed yet on the show yet, which is a key theme of the book, which is sexuality. It's such a crucial part of your argument with pornography, with the issue of gay sexuality, sexual repression. If you could, in a few minutes before we go to our next caller, just sort of summarize the role sexuality plays and how the Christian right deals with sexuality and sort of the record versus the rhetoric.
Well, I mean, we know that the Christian right is obsessed with homosexuality. And this is a movement that is purportedly heterosexual, but cares as much about homosexuals as homosexual men do, which is interesting. And anyone who's in the Christian right or who's come out of it knows that many of the men in the movement are repressed homosexuals.
You know, I've got to stop you because there was this one study late in the book you referred to from the 90s where they did this test of men. And I'll let you explain it because I'm sure you could do a better job about the relationship of repressed homosexuality and homophobia.
Yeah, there's actually scientific evidence that there is a relationship between homophobic opinions and repressed homosexuality. Three researchers from the University of Georgia investigated this link in 1996. They surveyed 50 self-declared heterosexual males on their opinions of gays. These are people who say that they were heterosexual. And then they divided them into two groups, a homophobic group that had a negative opinion of homosexuals and the non-homophobic group. Then they attached sensors to all of the study subjects' penises, measuring increase in circumference of their penis as they watched gay pornography. And those who expressed the most homophobic opinions registered the largest increase in penis circumference while they watched gay porn. Those who were non-homophobic registered almost no increase in penis circumference. The findings of this experiment suggest a clue as to why the radical right, which is the most homophobic movement in American political history has become a sanctuary for repressed gay men, from Ted Haggard to Larry Craig, who was the third most conservative senator in the Senate at the time that he was caught with a wide stance.
So I let's just one other point on that, if we could, because you also, I mean, the personal history of most of the members of the right, despite all the moralism, is that this is a movement riddled with all sorts of divorce and illegitimate birth. And
yeah.
I mean, the statistics, again, in the book are striking.
Yeah, I mean, one, the statistics in the Bible Belt, where the movement holds sway, show this culture of personal crisis writ large. I mean, these regions are responsible for all of the so much of the negative statistics we see. In, for example, in teen pregnancy, a study, Ad Health, a congressionally funded study in 2008, showed that white evangelical women have lose their virginity at an earlier age than any other demographic besides Black Protestants, who mostly live in the inner city. So that partly explains the appeal of Sarah Palin, who had a daughter who was pregnant through an out-of-wedlock, had an out-of-wedlock pregnancy at the age of 17, while Palin was advocating abstinence-only education. And in Lubbock, Texas, where abstinence-only education has been mandated since 1996, the rate of gonorrhea infections among adolescents is twice the national average, and other STDs are exploding because these things don't work. I mean, I can go on for the rest of the show about.
No, this, we could do an entire program on that whole issue, Max Lumenthal, but yeah. It is a central theme in the book. Republican Gomorrah that we're talking about today in the program. Let's go back to the phone lines now again to patient callers. Let's now go to line three, Champaign County. You're on the air with Max Blumenthal.
Hi, very pleased to be. I know your body of work, which I've seen some of it on Democracy Now!, you have a lot on YouTube, includes interviews with, I guess I've been trying to think of, call them Jewish fundamentalists. And I thought I'd ask you to review the complexity of the Hagi, the Christian Zionist nexus. And then, if I might be allowed another, there's a book out called The Family, and I've only heard the interviews. I heard a great interview with you with Doug Henwood, which I commend to people if they want more on the audio version of your. But anyway, the allegation there was that as early as in the 50s and the 60s, there was this group of movers and shakers who were sort of actually backing the Indonesian coup. So if you would comment on that, that sort of connection to, they're both sort of connections to world geopolitics, if you would, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you very much, caller. Max Blumenthal?
Well, the caller referred to Pastor John Hagee, who is one of the foremost leaders of the Christian Zionist movement, which is becoming dominant within the Christian right. They support Israel. And especially the most right-wing elements of Israel, and are pushing Israel to become increasingly authoritarian and more militaristic than it has already been, because they believe that the Palestinians need to be forced out of biblical Israel in order to fulfill biblical prophecy, to draw all of the Jewish diaspora into Israel, creating the conditions for Christ's return, in which Jews will be forced to convert to Christianity, or be thrown into an everlasting lake of fire during the rapture. And Israel has deliberately cultivated Hagee and other Christian Zionists as an ally, and they consider the Bible Belt to be their safety belt because many Jews, including myself, are disgusted by the occupation of the Palestinians and the unremitting brutality of Israel towards its neighbors and towards religious minorities within Israel. But these evangelical Christian Zionists are not. In fact, they celebrate it as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And in reference to Indonesia and the coup there by Suharto, who I don't think was a Bible believing Christian, the Christian right and its early evangelical antecedents in the 50s and 60s have supported Every anti-communist rogue regime, from the apartheid government of South Africa to Indonesia to Israel, and they've done it out of their belief that communism was a satanic ideology that repressed the role of the church in society. Since the end of the Cold War, Israel has become a central area of interest for the movement because of the belief that Islam, or what's commonly referred to as radical Islam, is really just a continuation of the satanic theology that was embodied by communism. As one member of Hagee's movement told me, we are fighting what is behind the Muslim people, which is Satan. And the reason they believe that is because Islam is a proselytizing religion, which is competing for followers and will not allow Christian missionaries to operate in the Middle East. So by essentially eradicating them through a nuclear war, which they openly yearn for, they can have a big opportunity to spread Christianity and hasten the coming of the Messiah.
Max Blumenthal, author of Republican Gomorrah, our guest today in Media Matters. You've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. Max Blumenthal, one of the subjects that didn't come up into your book, but has been in the news in the past 2 or 3 years, but only on the far margins, certainly not in the mainstream news, has been the increase in far-right Christian theological, even Christian Zionist politics within our military. And I think that's sort of a troubling development to the extent it's true. Are you familiar with much of this writing or this pattern? Is there something going on here?
Yeah, and this is something that isn't being tracked by anyone except consistently by Mikey Weinstein and the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, who I think are up for a Nobel Prize next year for the work they've done in exposing the rise of Christian Zionism and extreme right-wing politics, evangelical politicking and proselytizing within the military, which violates military rules on religious freedom, which are pretty strict because the military is supposed to be, at least within the military, sort of an egalitarian institution. Mikey Weinstein's own sons were bullied by evangelical proselytizers and even attacked physically, which started his crusade. James Dobson was recently replaced at Focused on the Family by the former CEO of Northrop Grumman, who's a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. Dobson has helped oust the mainline Christian chaplaincy at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, installing friendly pastors who believe in end times theology, like Johnny Weda, which is extremely dangerous for the military. This trend started after Vietnam, when the military began deliberately recruiting evangelicals into the officer corps because evangelical Christians were the only group that still held a positive view of the military after the Vietnam War. And it's created this problem, and I think the problem could come to a head from what I've been hearing from good sources about the photos from Bagram Air Base and Guantanamo Bay, which Obama has refused to release. Now, George W. Bush, who is much more conservative than Obama, was content to release the Abu Ghraib photos, which showed horrible things. And we've been told that these photos contained images of sodomy, which are not that much worse than those from Abu Ghraib. But what I've been hearing is actually that these are images of religious humiliation of Muslims at the feet of crosses, of the desecration of Qurans, and of images that could cause riots and renewed insurgency in the tribal regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan and in Iraq, and that therefore the Christian right would be revealed, if this scenario proved true, as a national security threat.
Our guest, Max Blumenthal, this is Media Matters. Let's go to our last phone call now. It's been waiting very patiently. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'll try to talk quick. I have not had a chance to read the book, and I'm dying to read the book. I did want to ask, wasn't John Hagee Bush's personal spiritual advisor throughout his 8 years?
He was not. Bush had a variety of spiritual advisors, and Hagee wasn't among them, although he was. I can't even document. The White House just released its visitor log from the Bush years, and I haven't heard about him being there, although I do know that James Dobson was once welcomed to the Bush White House for a meeting on Iran policy, which is sort of disturbing, and I assume Hagee was also in the room. But Hagee was not. He was, however, attempt to position himself as a spiritual advisor to John McCain during the 2008 campaign when he endorsed McCain. Of course, McCain didn't believe in anything Hagee believed in. It was a cynical political ploy, and it blew up in McCain's face when Hagee was revealed as a Holocaust revisionist who had said that the Holocaust was a divinely ordained phenomenon designed by God to bring the Jews to Israel to fulfill biblical prophecy. McCain had to cut him loose and said, the reason I picked Hagee was bad vetting. Then he goes ahead and selects Sarah Palin as vice president, so I don't think he'd really tightened up his vetting process very much.
Caller, are you still there? I guess the caller is gone, too. Well, let's wrap up with just a couple of looking forward, if we can, Max Blumenthal. I mean, two key figures in the book. You've already spoken at length about Sarah Palin. Another crucial figure on the political horizon, Mike Huckabee, shows up in the book at a number of points. And these seem to be, if I'm correct, the two present politicians angling to be the top dog, so to speak, of the Christian right in the 2012 presidential race. And then the third character shows up in your book, and I hesitate to use the term pathetic, would be Mitt Romney, who sort of did whatever he could to appeal to the right. What's your sense of the Republican Party presidential aspirants right now and their relationship to the political right?
Well, Romney and Pawlenty are the two front runners. They're going to attempt to run campaign around the economy. Romney's an economics expert who, to his credit, understands how the economy works. I disagree with his remedy for the economy. He favors outsourcing the American workforce and has been paid as a consultant to help companies outsource for years. And I was just talking to a leading social conservative who's been close to Bush and McCain, and he told me if Romney or Pawlenty attempt to focus the campaign on the economy, we will sabotage them. We're going to force them to talk about social issues, and if they don't use the language we want them to use, we'll destroy them. And I do agree that's what would happen. Pawlenty and Romney are seen, besides the fact that Romney's a Mormon, as inauthentic cardboard men in suits by the evangelical movement and by the Catholic right. And that means that they're going to have to nominate, if they get the election, a vice president in the mold of Palin or Huckabee. Huckabee's going to run. He can't win, but he's going to run for vice president. And Sarah Palin, whether she runs or not, is a folk hero to the Republican Party, the most nationally recognized figure, and the whole campaign will be run in her shadow. We've already seen a moderate Republican Senate candidate from Illinois, Mark Kirk, who's pro-choice, solicit Sarah Palin's endorsement to fend off a challenge from his right. He's terrified of Palin and the influence she commands. And that scenario will replicate itself in 2012 through Romney or Pawlenty, who will need Sarah Palin's endorsement and move forward into a general campaign.
So if I understand your argument, Max Blumenthal, at least one of the two positions on the 2012 ticket will have to be someone certified and personally approved by James Dobson and his crew.
Whether it's Dobson or not, it will be someone who is in the mold of Dobson, whose mentality and political sensibility has been cultivated through the influence of Dobson. And Sarah Palin, who was anointed by Dobson, will be one of the figures to do the vetting. The movement is still able to command the Republican grassroots.
Well, on that note, Max Blumenthal, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear us out of the studio. I want to thank Max Blumenthal, our guest today, the author of the new book by Nation Books, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Max, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you all listeners for joining us this week as well. I want to thank Melissa Truntz, my producer, for doing a great job as always. And I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for working the board. My name is Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours with Barbara Ehrenreich talking about her new book. Join us then. Have a great week, everyone.
To Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area, today there's a 50% chance of rain with a high near 54 degrees, and rain continues tonight and throughout the week with a low tonight of 41, rain on Monday with a high of 49, rain Monday night with a low of 42, and Tuesday's high 49 degrees. This is Illinois Public Media, WIOD.